Diversion Audio.
A note. This episode contains mature content and descriptions of violence that may be disturbing for some listeners. Please take care in listening. This is episode 2 of a 2-part miniseries. If you haven't listened to episode 1 of The Catfish Killer, I recommend you press pause, go listen to episode 1, and then come back here. Because episode 1 is important. But this episode is where the story becomes totally wild. Imagine you get into work one day, and your assignment is 3 giant garbage bags full of shredded paper. You're supposed to put all those sheets of paper back together, one tiny strip at a time, with just a few little letters to go on. And since the actual contents of those documents is near gibberish half the time, your job is 20 times harder. Actually, to me, it sounds almost impossible. But that's the job assigned to Special Agent Miranda Gaddis at the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations. She spent a month matching letter after letter, taping strips of paper together, one sheet at a time. But she did it, and she provided investigators in Mountain City, Tennessee, with exactly the evidence they needed to take not one, not two, not three, but 4 murderers to court.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Welcome to the greatest true crime stories ever told. I'm Mary Kay McBrayer. I'm a writer of true crime. In my work, I'm constantly reading about crime, but I'm not necessarily interested in the headline-grabbing stuff like the blood and the gore. I'm more interested in the people behind these stories and what we can learn about society by looking at their experiences. You can meet me here every week when I dig into crimes where a woman is not just a victim. She might be the detective, the lawyer, the witness, the coroner, criminal, or some combination of those. As you probably already know, women can do anything. Today's episode is the conclusion of our 2-part miniseries, The Catfish Killer. Nothing in this story is simple or straightforward. That much was clear last week when we heard about the baffling online feud plaguing Mountain City, Tennessee, and the devastating double murder of Billie Jean Hayworth and Bill Payne. But that was just the beginning of this story, because now we get into the twisted and bizarre underbelly of the crime. It's a saga of lies, manipulation, secret identities, and secret agencies that I, for one, could never have imagined. At the beginning of last week's episode, the first part of this story, I talked about how the internet has complicated our communication. I want to mention this quickly here again at the top of part two, because it's fundamental to our story. Technology makes communication both easier and harder. But communication in a small circle complicates it even more. I think that's partly because there's no one to check against. There's no control group. There's no touchstone for normalcy. So if you're about to fly off the rails, you can't look back and see that no one else is going there with you. Plus, if you get the right group together, or rather the wrong group, they can feed into each other's bullshit and build it up into something it's not. And it takes almost no time at all. You know, like on a reality show, one of those shows where they get a bunch of strong personalities together, and before the end of the first week, two of them are fist fighting over one eating the other's peanut butter. Just keep that in mind as we return to our story. Last time we were in Mountain City, Tennessee, it was February 6th, 2012, and a man named Jamie Curd had just confessed to assisting in the brutal murders of young mother Billie Jean Hayworth and her boyfriend Bill Payne, who also happened to be Jamie's cousin. But police didn't see Jamie as the real catch. He confessed to committing this double homicide with Buddy Potter, the father of his secret girlfriend, Janelle Potter. Jamie said he and Buddy killed Billie Jean and Bill to protect Janelle, who you'll remember from the first part of this story, was in the midst of a vicious feud with the young couple. But Jamie insisted Buddy was the one with the plan. Buddy was the one shooting the bullets. And looking at quiet, nervous Jamie, police believed that. So investigators tried to set up a little sting. The police had Jamie call Buddy and ask him, "Did you get rid of all the stuff from Bill's?" And Buddy replied, "Uh-huh." And that was enough for them to arrest Buddy. In the early hours of February 7th, 2012, they hauled him down to the station and started their questioning. Buddy repeated what the Potter family had said to police already. As a reminder, that's Buddy, his wife Barbara, and Janelle. He reiterated his family did have issues with the murdered couple, but they didn't know anything about their deaths. So the police took out a tape and played it for him.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Is Buddy around?
Yeah, did you have a lie detector?
Yeah.
And you passed it?
Yeah. You got rid of everything that was from Bill, didn't you? Okay. That makes me feel a lot better.
The police had recorded Jamie's call to Buddy Potter. That's a real snippet of the tape. It's from a TV docudrama called Too Pretty to Live, based on a book by Dennis Brooks of the same name. You just heard Bill admitting to getting rid of the stuff from Bill's. When Buddy heard that tape in the interrogation room, his face went white. He lost his cocky confidence. For several minutes, he sat there looking stunned. He muttered that he must have misheard what Jamie said. Police exchanged glances. He might not be cracking yet, but this was good. They would get there. It took time. It took prodding and a lot of different angles. It took more than it had taken with Jamie. But when the detective suggested the only reason you did it was because you were scared for your family and you love your family, Buddy said, yes. And then he said more.
When you hear people plotting to catch your daughter, murder her, they want to rape her because she's a virgin.
In your mind, you had no other choice, but
no.
Again, that's a real clip from the station that day. Again, from Too Pretty to Live. Buddy says one more important thing after that. He says the victims had, quote, put a $3,000 bounty on Janelle's head, on my wife, and me. All of that, that is why he did it. So, let's take a beat here. What is happening? I mean, police were looking for a confession that Buddy committed the murders. And they were getting that, so that's great. But Buddy was saying that he did it because Billie Jean Haworth and Bill Payne wanted to rape and murder Janelle and had put a bounty on his whole family. That just doesn't add up. Billie Jean and Bill might have had their differences with Janelle and the Potters, but they were new parents and all around nice people, well-liked in their community, with no one else in Mountain City ever reporting any kinds of problems with them. And even Janelle's vocal public complaints about harassment from the couple and their friends hadn't included anything this, frankly, terrifying. Maybe what sticks out most to me, though, is how would Billie Jean and Bill have access to hitmen? So police were also baffled, but they couldn't show that to Buddy. They had to keep pushing for more information here. So they asked him to call his wife and daughter and confess his crime to them. They said he should tell them directly. He should tell them about what he did.
Brian?
Barbara.
Yeah.
Before you find out somebody else, I want you to know I was involved in it. And I did it.
I don't understand that. Well,
I didn't want you to be afraid no more.
Didn't you think about it more? Because you're sitting right here and I saw you.
Once again, that's taped from the real call. From the Too Pretty to Live movie. And it's an odd phone call. Janelle hops on the line too, but neither she nor Barbara really sounded shocked or upset. Instead, they offered Buddy alibis. They both insisted it's not possible that he did it. He was home with them. Maybe that's what Buddy needed to hear in order to shut up. Because when he got off the phone, he asked for a lawyer. The interrogation was officially over. Still, it was a valuable call for the cops. Because after hearing Barbara and Janelle's reactions, For the first time, the investigators were starting to wonder if they were involved too. I mean, think about it. Maybe you would provide an alibi to a loved one that had committed a horrible crime. I don't know. It's a human response, I guess, to save someone you love. It's hard to imagine what I'd do in a situation like this, but if I had to guess, yeah, I'd be pretty shocked that anyone I loved would do something like that. But I can also see myself potentially thinking, well, what was their reason? And being open to hearing them out. I mean, not just anyone. I'm talking about like a core four loved ones, tops, who I'd give the benefit of the doubt. But I definitely can't see myself having no reaction. If you had no idea about the crime and were hearing it for the first time, wouldn't you express shock and horror at what was happening first? Before you started throwing out alibis? Barbara and Janelle didn't, which made police think that they already knew. They might have two culprits in custody, Jamie Curd and Buddy Potter. But maybe they should be looking for more. So the police searched the Potter home and Buddy's truck. In the Potter home, an officer Woodward was sitting in the living room, logging evidence descriptions into a notebook as other officers brought him item after item. Notebooks, stacks of paper. Sitting across from him was Barbara Potter. And then she was standing next to him, reaching down to the stack of papers at his left and ripping them up. Woodward looked up at her, incredulous, and asked slowly, "What have you got there?" Barbara didn't say anything. She just handed back the stack. Some of the papers were torn now, but Woodward could see clearly what they were. Photographs, printed out on a home computer, of Billie Jean Hayworth and her friends, like Lindsay Thomas, in bikinis and sexy Halloween costumes. Very normal, cute photos, the kind anyone would have posted on Facebook. But scrawled underneath them were captions, like Billy Whore and Pan Face. Pan Face was the same name the so-called Matt Potter had used in his horrible, angry topics posts. The ones that started the whole feud between the Potters, Billie Jean, and her friends. So, another link between the Potter family and these posts. Another link showing just how much the Potter family hated Billie Jean. Like, who does that? Printing out photos of girls from Facebook and writing cruel names underneath? It was the behavior of an angry child. But there were no children in this house. Only 30-year-old Janelle and her middle-aged parents. Back at Buddy's truck, police made an even bigger discovery. There were the bullets. They were the same kind of bullets used in the murders. But they also matched in a more specific way. They had little markings on top, almost like someone was doodling on them with a carving knife. That matched the bullets used in the murder, too. So, bingo. More evidence that Buddy did shoot the gun. But that's not even the biggest piece of evidence they found in his truck. And literally, I mean physically huge. In the back of the truck, there were three garbage bags full of shredded paper, like ready to burst open. Police immediately asked an agent at the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation to put these documents back together. Special Agent Miranda Gaddis the woman, the saint, the one I mentioned back near the beginning of this episode. This is the fun part of looking back in time, because we get to skip over the grueling, weeks-long puzzle work Miranda had to do to get her results. And the results she got were very strange. The papers turned out to be printouts of emails. Emails between Barbara Potter and someone signing off as Chris. Chris. Remember Chris from the last episode, who may or may not be associated with the CIA? The one Jamie Curd mentioned in his interrogation? These printouts, as well as the digital files police obtained from both the Potter family and Jamie Curd's email accounts, suddenly revealed a lot more about who Chris was, about his association with the CIA, and about what exactly he had to do with the double murder of Billie Jean Haworth and Bill Payne.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
I want to go on a bit of a journey with you here into the massive archive of emails from Chris. In addition to those printouts, police also get warrants for digital files and end up with more emails, Facebook messages between Chris and Barbara, and texts between Chris and Jamie. No messages between Janelle and Chris, though. Buddy didn't use email or any other digital communication, so no messages between him and Chris either. But mentions in the messages between Barbara and Chris. Plus, all those shredded printouts in Buddy's car show that Barbara passed the messages on to her husband. He was up to date on the conversations. And let me tell you, they are a trip. They span about a year, starting in late 2010, right around the time that Billie Jean Haworth got pregnant and moved in with Bill Payne. And they continue right up until the time of Bill and Billie Jean's murders. Chris introduces himself as a CIA operative from the same area of Pennsylvania the Potters moved from. He was actually born in the same hospital on the same day as Janelle and attended school with her. But in 2010, Chris is getting in touch with the Potters in a professional capacity because he has been following events in Mountain City and sees that Janelle is in danger from people like Billie Jean Haworth, Bill Payne, and Lindsay Thomas. These people are scary and dangerous. They are tied up in serious drug dealing, and they hate Janelle. In fact, they have violent intentions towards her. He knows what they say about her behind closed doors. They want to rape her. They want to murder her. Eventually, Chris tells them that Mountain City's local drug dealing gangsters have put a bounty on the heads of all the Potters. But Chris knows that Janelle is a sweet, good person. These people are after her because of that, and because she is so pretty, prettier than them. Chris is here to protect her. That's why he keeps the Potters and Jamie updated on what's happening at the Payne residence. That's why he writes posts as Matt Potter on topics defending Janelle. That's why he wants to kill all Janelle's enemies before they kill her. No wonder the Potters were so scared. Chris also tells both Jamie and Barbara that Jamie is a victim of the gang's hatred as well. He's in it too. That seems to be why, in the spring of 2011, when Jamie's mom died, the Potter parents decided to reach out to him, and they invited him into their home as a family friend. Although Janelle and Jamie still keep their romantic relationship a secret, now they can see each other much more frequently. So that's the content of these messages. Pretty terrifying stuff. But I need to read some of them aloud for you guys. I'm not going to preface it before I read this time. But remember, Chris says that he's the one writing the Matt Potter posts. And if you remember those from the last episode, well, this should sound familiar. May 2011. Lindsay will back off fast and stop things. But that's if I let her live. I choose that for her boyfriend and Bill and Billy and that damn baby. I will see when I want to kill them. Then I'm getting some of the cops. No one would ever miss them. I'm going up to Bulldog Road now. And I'm also going to run into Whorepan Slut Face Ugly as a mud faced bitch and her fucker of a BF. I'm getting on where they are going and what they do and getting a lot of sense about what they do daily. So I have been on them. They are calling from bills, go to a payphone and say something. They are playing games. So, meet Chris. Government agent, gifted by the feds with guns, and as he tells Barbara and Jamie, licensed to kill. And yet, his grammar is terrible. He can't spell. He sounds less like a government employee and more like, I honestly don't know, like maybe a very angry teenager. But somehow, Jamie and Barbara seem to buy into this. And this gets back to that initial sort of paranoia and suspicion that was a part of Barbara all the time. That expectation that people were out to get her and her family, and that disliking someone translated into wanting to harm them. Jamie, meanwhile, I wonder if maybe he was so desperate to get closer to Janelle, and Chris kind of brought them closer. not just by getting Barbara to warm up to him, but also by giving them this common enemy and something to talk about. Janelle talked to Jamie about Chris a lot. He was like a brother to her, she told him. Meanwhile, investigators honed in on some other factors here. First, this so-called CIA agent was so interested in Janelle. In fact, she seemed like his main interest. He was constantly tracking her enemies, and he couldn't stop praising her. Second, while Janelle's language was a lot less violent, she never cursed even, Chris's writing style, including consistent spelling quirks, matched hers very closely. A linguist forensics expert confirmed this. Third, all Chris's emails came from the Potter family IP address, and they all came from Janelle's accounts. Let me repeat that. Every single message Chris sends, whether it was an email, a text, or a Facebook message, came from Janelle's accounts or phone number. The explanation for this was that Chris was hacking into Janelle's accounts to communicate because, of course, as a CIA agent, you could do things like that, and in fact, had to do things like that to keep a low profile. This explanation is so absurd that it would be funny if two people hadn't been murdered. And then there's the fact that as 2011 wears on, and Jamie and the Potter parents get more paranoid about the gang that was out to kill them, Chris keeps upping the ante and stoking their fear. But he never actually materializes to quote-unquote get rid of their enemies. No one has ever actually seen Chris in real life, ever. None of this seems to raise Barbara, Jamie, or Buddy's suspicions, but it does prompt Barbara to start pushing for something. She wants Chris to get Buddy a CIA badge so he has license to kill like Chris apparently has. She sends messages like this one, and another heads up, she has her own unhinged writing style. Quote, Bud is so mad, and I'm 100% behind whatever happens. You guys meet when you are ready, Chris. Maybe Bud will have ID by then and can use CIA guns, etc. for his protection, get the jobs done, you know. They all need to go, and the ones left need to be given a big scare as they watch and wonder, am I next? In late November 2011, Barbara also sends this message to Jamie. By the way, if you talk/text with Chris, ask him if he thinks the CIA will back up Buddy if he takes it into his own hands. He is worried he will get locked up for doing nothing, or, you know, what a worry. They are trying to kill Janelle little by little. It seems that they are going to keep going after all of us until we're dead/gone. Not right, and the cops are behind them, per Chris. By the end of 2011, Barbara and Buddy no longer expect Chris to kill their enemies for them. That much they've come to terms with. So they are ready to take things into their own hands and kill Bill Payne and Billie Jean Hayworth themselves, hopefully with the approval of the CIA. All because of the hatred Chris had been spewing at them for the past year. Now, I should point out, in case you had any doubts, there's no evidence that anything Chris said was true regarding gangs, bounties, or violent plans to hurt the Potter family. In fact, there's evidence that a lot of the things Chris was saying were untrue. He created this terrifying danger out of nothing. He created the hatred. He, in effect, caused the murders for no reason. Barbara contributed by spreading the hate, by believing in it without a second thought, and by helping plan the murder. Buddy and Jamie actually committed the crime. But none of it would have happened without Chris, his lies, and the hatred he had planted in the fertile soil of the Potter home. Investigators and eventually Dennis Brooks, the Tennessee prosecutor tasked with litigating the case, were convinced of that. And after looking at the mountains of evidence, they were convinced that they knew exactly who Chris really was.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
L-A-S-I-K, LASIK.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Chris gave Barbara and Jamie his full name a few times. Chris Jaden, spelled with a T. That's T-J-A-D-E-N. He also attached photos of himself to some of his messages. Lots in law enforcement uniforms. One at a Phillies game. Always a handsome, young man. Investigators were startled to find that he was, in fact, a real person. Had actually gone to school with Janelle back in Pennsylvania. Now, he lived in Delaware, where he did work in law enforcement. Are you as confounded as I was when I heard this information? Then the police contacted him. Chris sounded genuinely surprised to get the call. Really shocked at questions about Mountain City, Tennessee, the CIA, and Janelle. He didn't know anything about Mountain City, much less anyone who lived there. He worked in law enforcement, yes, but as a constable at a local hospital, not for Central Intelligence. He did remember Janelle, although he didn't really know her. They'd gone to high school together. She had acted like she had a crush on him, and he had tried to be nice to her, but he never gave it much thought. He was handsome and popular. She was a little odd. After graduation, he never thought about her ever again, not once. Until now, obviously. Those photos of him, some of them were profile pictures from his Facebook, accessible to the public, including people he wasn't friends with on the platform, like Janelle. Some of them weren't actually him. They were photos of very similar-looking guys. He pointed out a picture of a man in a uniform. One officers had assumed was him. The likeness was so good. But Chris said he'd never worn that kind of uniform. Maybe the photos of him available on the internet weren't enough for whoever had stolen his identity. As Dennis Brooks points out in Too Pretty to Live, who knows how long the real culprit spent scraping through the internet looking for photos of men who were a match. Because whoever these investigators from Tennessee were looking for, they believed Chris Jaden. It wasn't him. It was, and I think you've probably come to the same conclusion as the cops at this point, Janelle. All along, sitting up on that computer that had been her lifeline for so long, it was Janelle, posing as Chris, turning him into a creature of her own making, someone obsessed with her, her safety, and her enemies, someone who would kill for her, someone who would get the real people in her life to kill for her. It's a really hard thing to wrap your head around. Or at least it was hard for me. I get jealousy, which it seems pretty clear Janelle felt towards Billie Jean, and by extension, her friends. I get rejection, poisoning what was once a crush for Bill. I even get trash-talking all of these people. But Janelle did something so much more extreme. I mean, she catfished her parents and her boyfriend, and she manipulated them into committing murder. I keep thinking about that auditory disorder she had. I wonder if maybe she misunderstood some of her social interactions with the Mountain City locals. And I know how it feels in those small towns. I said it at the top of the last episode for a reason. Those are the kinds of places where everyone will do anything for the people they know and love, but they can be hard on outsiders. Maybe Janelle did get made fun of or feel left out, and that stings. Maybe for Janelle, because of her disorder, it did more than just sting. But the fact of the matter is, whatever she thought she heard, she went on to make up blatant lies. And no matter how mean a comment might be, murder in response? That's obviously not okay. That's obviously wrong. We may never totally understand what went on in Janelle's head. She's never admitted to her role in these crimes, not to being Chris or any of it. But Dennis Brooks and his team got her convicted. They got Barbara convicted. They got Buddy convicted. All on 2 counts of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. All sentenced to life in prison. All 3 of them have appealed their convictions. Janelle and Buddy's were upheld in court. Barbara was eventually granted a new trial on the grounds that her original attorney presented a conflict of interest because he had previously represented Buddy. But the case never actually made it back to trial. Barbara pled guilty to 2 counts of facilitating first-degree murder in exchange for a reduced sentence, 25 years. For the first time ever, she admitted some amount of guilt, at least, even if we're still waiting on Janelle. Jamie Curd cooperated with the prosecution from the start, not only admitting guilt, but doing extensive interviews with the prosecution. So during the original trial, he received the same plea deal that Barbara eventually got from the get-go. 25 years in prison for 2 counts of facilitating first-degree murder. None of it brings back the parents of that baby. He's going to spend his whole life without the parents who loved him, who would have cherished him and supported him. Nothing can change that. But justice has been served, and that's in no small part thanks to the tenacity of Dennis Brooks in navigating the wild ins and outs of this crazy case. His book, Too Pretty to Live, breaks down his account of the madness. And I'm lucky enough to have spoken to him about the case myself. That's coming up after the break. Stay with us. Dennis, it is so nice to meet you. And thank you so much for coming to talk to me. I just wanted to jump right in and ask, because this is so compelling to me, will you talk a little more about the Potter family dynamics? Because I just feel like there have to have been some conditions that made Janelle into the kind of person who would do what she did. And then there were probably some things that made her parents into the kind of people who would respond to what she did with murder.
My conclusion was they had all sort of victimized one another, that, Janelle grew up with some disabilities. I think she was in special education, had a high school diploma that was special ed related. She wasn't, totally unable to do things, but she had some limitations, some challenges. And I took it from her history and from talking to her older sister, Christy, who did not have those types of limitations, that Janelle had led a sheltered upbringing, even into adulthood, staying there at the family's home, being cared for as a child still, even into her late 20s, and not really having the ability or the freedom to grow and sprout her own wings. And I think that manifested itself in a loneliness that was natural for her. And she took that in directions that were unhealthy. Now, likewise, her ability to manipulate her parents and get them to believe things that weren't necessarily true, she victimized them in turn. And I think it's just sort of a perfect storm of a sort of dysfunction that breeds something that's unimaginably horrible for people who are probably totally unsuspecting of what was going on.
So as we are moving into deeper into the internet age, are there any other cases that remind you of this one?
The Potter family, they committed one of the worst things that's ever happened in our 4-county district. And it's surprising, it's not typical. I don't think it's typical here or probably anywhere else, but obviously the internet plays its way into cases now where it didn't before. Our murder files are now voluminous because we're getting phone dumps, phone extraction reports, and Facebook Messenger search warrant returns. And, they're a whole lot more convoluted and you've got a whole lot more information. And, sometimes a lot of that electronic communications become really imperative in your cases.
Does the advance in technology make the justice system better or worse, or is it easier or harder? What do you think?
Well, you have the limitations of time. You've only got so much time in the day to be able to devote to a case. And, the Potter case was pretty much my work life for a significant amount of time, which means all those aggravated burglaries and rapes and DUIs that were also on my docket didn't get my attention as much. And that's a cost. People don't understand when it's a complicated case, then that becomes the only thing you've got to do. Because when you walk in there in front of the jury, you've got to present the case, which means not only just I'm going to give them information, but I've got to cull out the information that they need to hear. The Potter case, we put in 206 pages. I still remember 206 pages of emails total, but that wasn't even 10% of what I had to go through. And I had to go through them over and over and over and keep culling them out. And when I wrote the book, I had to do the same thing because, I felt like I had to show the insanity to the reader.
What does your work day look like when you're doing something like that?
Typically, I'll go in early to work and I've got two or three things I really want to accomplish. I'm lucky if I can get half of one of them accomplished because I'm always interrupted by victims calling in or, somebody on the staff asking questions about something or officers having search warrants for me to look at. And so it's really hard to focus on something that is convoluted and complex. And I remember on the Potter case, I would actually take my laptop and go over to the local park and just sit out there without my phone for hours where I could concentrate on it. And there was one time me and my wife went to Las Vegas, and during the 4-hour flight out there, I had my laptop out reading Janelle's emails and categorizing them, because, you know, I'm not being bothered then. But you can only devote so much time like that to so many cases at one time in your career. You can't do that with all of them.
Doing that. So, like, I guess, I mean, this is the book. So this is one of the big two or three of your career. So how do you celebrate when you get a big victory like that?
You just hug the families who are involved and you go on. And you know, for me, I started writing a book because it was the day after the verdict, and you know, I took the day off, and the case just wouldn't shut off in my head. I'm sitting there thinking, you know, somebody's going to write a book about this. So I wonder if I could. And I just opened up a computer and I wrote a whole chapter in a flash, it seemed like. And I looked back at it, and I thought, yeah, that sounds pretty good for me, I thought. And I just kept going, and it was a way to release the case from my brain.
Oh, absolutely. What are the biggest lessons that you've carried with you from this case or from writing about the case?
One motivation I had for writing the book was that hopefully someone out there who was a criminal investigator, an aspiring criminal investigator, or an aspiring or current prosecutor, could have a story where they see, you know, the sausage being made on something that's complicated and important, and maybe inspire them to go that extra length to pursue justice. You know, it's real simple to prosecute some people, but other people are also culpable, but it's going to take a little more work. And, you know, you hope that, you know, if it was your family member that was affected, that, you know, as a victim, that someone would take enough interest to go the extra mile and get this done. And I thought this was a good example of it having happened. You know, my co-counsel, Matt Rourke, and the TBI agent, Scott Lott, Johnson County Sheriff's Department, Joe Woodard, we'd worked as a team on it and put it together. And, you know, one of my favorite things about writing the book was I actually explained how, you know, in trying to prove Janelle and Barbara were writing what they were writing, Dr. Leonard, who was the forensic linguistic expert from Hofstra University — this was a fun story. He's way up in New York, and he sounds like a Yankee. He doesn't sound like anything like us, you know. But I'd found him on a Google search on one of those nights where I'm like, how do I prove that Janelle was writing this as Chris? And I found him, and I sent an email to him. I didn't figure he would answer, but like the next day, he responds, and he's like, yes, this is exactly the kind of case I work on. And I sent him all our stuff, and he's telling me, you know, what we really need, the gold standard for what I do, I need a known sample that they write by typing it. And, you know, we had a lot of known handwriting samples. You know, we had people to identify their handwriting as being theirs. But he said, you know, there can be some nuances in how they write handwriting versus how they write on a computer. So, you know, where our question samples or emails where they've typed on a computer, we really need known samples that are typed on a computer. And I posited that problem to Investigator Woodard over at Johnson County Sheriff's Department. I'm like, you know, we've got this problem. He says, we need that. And he says, well, it's funny. They've been coming around, Janelle and Barbara, wanting to make complaints about all these people trashing their house and vandalizing the property. I said, well, there you go. Bring them in there to your office, put them at the computer, tell them you want them to write everything they can so that you can look into this. So he's doing that one evening, and he's texting to me you know, I'm two counties away, and he's telling me, oh, they're there at the computer. I'm like, oh, that's great. And we're like scheming here, and they finally get done. And he sends me in the email what they had typed, and then I forward it to Dr. Leonard up at Hofstra. And by the end of the night, Dr. Leonard is examining their known writing samples. And, you know, they had no idea that we were doing that to them. That was a good team exercise to get one piece of the case. And it was an important piece because that really helped our known samples when we analyzed it against the question ones.
Yeah, I love to hear about that teamwork. I feel like we don't get to hear about that a lot. So love it when it works out like that. And that's so cool too, that they were like, we have a complaint. And they were like, by all means, please go right ahead. I love that. Okay. So I have one more question. What do you hope people take away from this? And what's the biggest takeaway for you? Like, what's the most important thing?
You know, and you see it when you watch the Catfish TV show on MTV, you know, they keep showing, and there's no telling how many people are out there in America, in the whole world, that are getting duped online by people that are pretending to be someone they're not. And I think people are, especially if you're more of a lonely type person, you're very susceptible to being induced to an emotional relationship with someone and having that exploited. And you see that on those TV shows such as that. And it's here in this case too. You know, sometimes they're just getting exploited of their emotions, their love, their money. But here, there's actually two people that died as a result of that kind of thing. And so it's something that people need to be aware of.
That's a great note to end on. And thank you so much for talking to me. I loved every second of it. Really grateful to have had this opportunity with you. So thank you. Join me next week on The Greatest True Crime Stories Ever Told for an episode on a woman who played a crucial role in taking down one of the biggest mob bosses in New York City, Lucky Luciano. I'm talking about one of our first female African-American lawyers and prosecutors in the United States, Eunice Hunton Carter. I'd also like to shout out a few key sources that made it possible for me to tell this story. First of all, Dennis Brooks' Too Pretty to Live, The Catfishing Murders of East Tennessee. You've heard me cite from it over the course of these past two episodes, and now you've heard from the author, Dennis Brooks, as well. But read it for yourself for even more detail. I also want to shout out the court documents from the case, which are available online and very informative. For information about this case and others we cover on the show, visit diversionaudio.com. Sign up for Diversion's newsletter and be among the first to hear about special behind-the-scenes features with the hosts and actors from Diversion's podcasts, more shows you'll love from Diversion and our partners, and other exclusive tidbits you can't get anywhere else. That's diversionaudio.com to sign up for the newsletter. The Greatest True Crime Stories Ever Told is a production of Diversion Audio. Your host is me, Mary Kay McBrayer. This episode was written by our editorial director, Nora Battelle. Our show is produced and directed by Mark Francis. Our development team is Emma DeMuth and Jacob Bronstein. Theme music by Tyler Cash. Executive producers, Jacob Bronstein, Mark Francis, and Scott Waxman.
Diversion Audio.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry.
With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.